Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hello, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to the program. Today, a continuation of the ongoing, in-depth, original investigative reporting series on AIDS, A Second Opinion, Deconstructing the Myth of AIDS. Specifically today, we're going to look at our misinterpretations, our misprescriptions of this condition. This is tape 21 in our series. We have already dealt with, on a rather extensive level, with how negative stereotypes of people with AIDS and pessimistic views of the course of the disease have been major engines to create anxiousness in those afflicted already at risk. We have even brought up how the soberized pronunciations of doctors on the HIV equation have contributed to the depressing atmosphere. Quite simply, we live in an environment of great fear and dread about this condition. Still, as we move on to an examination of how do we deal with people who are told that they're HIV positive or people with AIDS, it might be worthwhile to pause briefly to note some of the peculiar practices of doctors and lab technicians that have engaged in prescribing or prejudging in line with the flawed assumptions of orthodox rather than in accordance with the Hippocratic Oath injunction that a doctor do nothing that would harm the life of his or her patient. And as you will see from our discussion, doctors are doing a great deal that actually does harm the life of the patient. The first assumption is that those who belong to the risk groups are to be treated differently than others when it comes to checking for the presence of HIV. There is a magazine called Continuum. It is what I consider the finest magazine in existence on being objective and balanced and offering critiques that will challenge the orthodox view. In Continuum, they state that it has been confirmed that HIV antibody test labs use risk factor information before deciding on end results. The report flags a statement given out by Britain's Public Health Laboratory Services to the effect that, quote, since clinical testing began, all clinical specimens have been accompanied by information necessary to make an accurate diagnosis, unquote. This is to say, if the sample came from, say, an HIV drug user, then it would be put in a special category and treated differently. We could look at the situation in the United States to see what this different procedure is. The same article explains that as early as 1985, the CDC, quote, recommended blood samples from people suspected to be at high risk of HIV infection be heated at 56 degrees centigrade for 30 minutes before testing. This, it was claimed, would protect lab workers from risk of contamination. But, quote, heated blood samples led to a large number of otherwise negative samples testing positive, unquote. This is what one calls self-fulfilling prophecy. The second assumption is AIDS equals death. If doctors were not convinced of that, how explain the report presented at the 11th International Conference on AIDS in Vancouver that physician-assisted suicides for people with AIDS were common, but generally covered up? Quote, a survey in 1996 of 118 physicians who treat people with AIDS found that 53% had helped their terminal stage patients die. A similar survey in 1990 found that only 20% said they had helped their patients die. Unquote. This should not be taken to indicate that physicians themselves see suicide as a valid option, since there is evidence enough that people with AIDS are forward in entertaining this option. A British researcher also reported that between 10 and 20% of the patients with AIDS in British Columbia seek their doctor's help in dying. This same researcher found that in Canada, as a whole, 83% of the people with HIV and AIDS had looked on self-murder as a reasonable future option. So let me just recapitulate here for a moment. What my research has shown is that if you thought that the test you were getting for HIV antibody was just clear and objective proof that you had the virus, think again. That's why they ask you to fill out a questionnaire. And the questionnaire says, do you have certain risk factors? And if you have risk factors, the risk factor that you state you have could be what suddenly makes you go from HIV negative to HIV positive, not just the blood. Because what they'll find in the blood is generally not indicative of what could make you positive or negative by itself. So we are not told that there is a subjective element to this testing. But there is, and always has been. And then we weren't told that the procedures of the CDC was to heat the blood. Well, if you're heating the blood, when you heat the blood, it makes it more prone to being HIV positive. We weren't told that. No one was told that, well, we're going to heat the blood, and that's going to make you more likely, even if you're completely normal, to have an HIV positive. Well, what if you heated the blood and you ended up with a questionnaire that showed that a person could have what you consider risk factors? Well, the likelihood is that person would then be HIV positive, even if they were totally healthy and had nothing wrong with their body. That is how subjective this is. Now, from flawed, grossly, grossly perverse science and laboratory procedures and subjective questions, now you've told that you have the antibody, which you don't. But you're told, and now you're told that you must take these medications. And you start getting very stressed. And who wouldn't? What happens? A high percentage of people begin to realize, if my life's over, everything's going to change, and I'm going to be stigmatized and marginalized, why not just end it now? There are multiple examples of completely healthy people who tested positive on an antibody test, became so depressed they committed suicide. But outside of those that make the mainstream media and how they commit suicide, a note left behind or someone takes their case to the newspaper, what about all the tens of thousands of potential cases of people who are struggling with the treatment are getting worse because the treatment see no hope in their doctor's system and dying? That is not reported. Those stories are rarely brought to our attention. Let's examine the treatment of psychological factors that foster immune disease. From what has been said so far, the intelligent listener can probably surmise what the general outline of psychotherapist Dr. Schmidt's treatment that could be that he sees, and he was the foremost person in the country, if not the world, writing on how your mind can predispose you to the symptoms of AIDS without ever having any virus. Just what stress alone does. Stress can give you all the symptoms we now know of AIDS because stress, acute and chronic, can break down the immune system, and altered immune system can manifest in infections and disease that we then call AIDS, but are really individual disease caused by stress. Schmidt's treatment is unique because you could conjecture that he would try to combat the despair that can overpower a person with AIDS or HIV positivity, who is met by the negative images produced by the establishment. Also, he would act soothingly to uncover and heal some of the still festering wounds bestowed in the person's childhood. And lastly, recalling his comments on the general healthiness of ACT UP members, he might prescribe therapeutic political activism as a way to turn his or her repressed anger outward. Indeed, as to the first note, Schmidt urges, quote, an important element of recovery is hope. One must expect and believe that he or she will live, unquote. He cites a testimony of medical hypnotherapist Dr. Michael Ellner, Nick Ciano, author of No Time to Wait, Nathaniel Learman, MD, former clinical director of Kingsborough Psychiatric Center, and immunologist Dr. Alfred Hassig, who all agree with the last named, who says, quote, the sentences of death accompanying the medical diagnosis of AIDS should be abolished, and instead people with AIDS should be nurtured with hope. Hope should grow alongside justified anger. The type found, although Schmidt might not approve of this model since both hold to the bankrupt idea that HIV is the sole cause, the only cause of the immune disease. In Randy Schultz, when he cascades government backpedaling in a time of crisis, or Larry Kramer, who raged against New York City's do-nothing Koch administration. For Schmidt, he said, our survival depends on not accepting the role of victim. If people such as fundamentalist bigots directs death sentences at us, we should direct death wishes right back at them. No one should be allowed to attack us with impunity. At the same time, we need to retain a sense of cool, an appropriate balance of self-preservation, anger, and a sense of humor. Aside from the fact that our lives are at stake, current events really are pretty ridiculous, aren't they? Unquote. Asking him for more specific prescriptions for after I had read his books, I wanted to learn more about his actual treatments. I found first that given that HIV does not always lead to death, a positive person should avoid at all costs current drug treatments, all of which, quote, have toxicity and adverse side effects, which of themselves can cause severe illness, unquote. Taking them at an early stage of HIV infection could only be justified, quote, if there were, quote, 100% fatal outcome of positivity, which there is not. Therefore, taking the drugs early actually increases the likelihood of immune suppression. Turning more proactive direction, Smith says to me, quote, there are two things which need to be addressed in psychotherapy with anyone at risk for getting AIDS, the suicide syndrome and the somatization of feelings, unquote. By somatization, he means the tendency to choke back emotions which one was taught to repress in an emotionally cramped or abusive childhood, and which, as we saw, add to the self-hatred and the tension of continually bottled up feelings. These things have to be addressed vigorously. Once they're addressed, the person overcomes the difficulties in expressing feelings, stops somatizing, and the immune system has a chance to recover. And indeed, in my own work, since I've done several workshops with persons with AIDS, the very first thing I do is I don't tell them what nutrients to take or what diet to take. That's not the first thing. The very first thing is I ask people, what do you think about? What goes on in your mind all day long? And more often than not, the person is saying, dying, loss, looking at everything around me and wondering, how much longer will I be here to see this, to appreciate it? One man in a recent workshop that I had, persons with AIDS, said that every time he eats out or goes to a movie, he really focuses on it. Where before he would have enjoyed the camaraderie of his companion at a meal, now he focuses on the ambiance and the food and the presentation as if this were indeed his last meal. So he's very conscious, and he said if nothing else, his diagnosis of AIDS and his treatment has led him to appreciate more the small things of life in the moments that life comprises. He is more aware of the finiteness of life, takes nothing for granted. Everything becomes positive in his life. The time he spends with his cats each day, realizing the day will come when he won't have that time. He won't have that purr. He won't have that cat on his lap and stroking his back. So he says he really gives bonding time to everything, where before he did a lot of things that were superficial, that were not essential. It just filled time, obligatory things. He does nothing that's obligatory now. And he had been taking all the medications, AZT and DDI and antiretroviral cocktails, and it was only because he became so deathly ill and his immune system was so compromised that he, one day, at the advice of his lover, a New York City police officer, who I had worked with 2 years before and had helped recover completely, that he began this journey himself. Even though his lover had gone from sickness to wellness, and he saw all that he was doing, he still couldn't embrace it himself. That's how strong his beliefs were, that he was going to be dead. And he feared giving up anything his doctor said. But one morning he said he was vomiting in his toilet, and he was so sick he could barely carry himself back to his bed. And when he got back to his bed, he looked on his bedside table And there he saw 22 different medications, all different pills. And he had numbers on every bottle in case he forgot what the bottles were, because he was also suffering from dementia due to the medications. And he said, I can't get any sicker or I'll be dead. And I don't want to keep living if this is all that I'm going to face. It was that day that he called and said he'd like to come over for a support group. And he did. And this when I was asking him about the importance of each day and what he thought about life and people's reactions to him. And it was the stress of just impressions, the stress of the idea that he'd been given no hope, because he began to believe in that he had no hope. So if you don't think that how we feel about ourselves when we're sick counts, oh, it sure does, and that we have to become proactive and active, and we must address the psychotherapy. And if we don't, then we're going to somatize ourselves. So after doing a lot of work on how we should start to feel good about who we are and not concern ourselves about what other people think about us, start to see that all those suicidal thoughts gone. The idea that the hospital was the only place that we could feel safe and nurtured, gone. And it wasn't too much longer after that. About 4 weeks later, he started to get his health back, strength back, and then the protocol started to really kick in. Today, by the way, he is completely healthy, totally well, and is a member of the HEAL, which is under Michael Ellner, has helped thousands upon tens of thousands of people realize there are alternative approaches. Schmidt generalizes that the necessary first step is therapy that convinces the client that he does not have a disease that's going to kill him. And once the client has learned to trust in Schmidt, he says, quote, this usually results in him or her overcoming these inhibitions and expressing these feelings fully. It's quite wonderful to see this, he says, unquote. He mentioned one especially dramatic episode. He said, quote, I knew of one patient who cried for 3 to 5 hours a day for a solid 9 months. After that, his T cell started rising and has been rising ever since, unquote. I queried him about his other results, and he pointed to a patient he began working with in October 1992. He said he was having a gentle, slow decline in the number of T cells. Then, as soon as he started psychotherapy, the T cells rebounded. They've since gone up 47% in the last 5 months, which I think is significant. You bet it is, unquote. In concluding this section, I would like to review as much as summarize. Often philosophers of science distinguish between a strong and a weak version of a theory. And that is something I'm tempted to do in presenting this doctrine of mass hysteria, which is really a two-part theory elegantly cobbled together from strands taken from individual and collective psychology. The strong version of Schmidt's theories, the one he himself holds, be that under the increased social strain that falls collectively on fringe groups, many fall ill from AIDS individually because an early history of abuse has predisposed the person to internalize feelings. A weak version of this doctrine, which I would find easier to endorse, is that individuals' immune systems are taxed by the U.S.'s growing homophobic climate and the mass hysteria around AIDS invoked, and further by the establishment, which, along with other factors, leads to immune breakdown. After reviewing in the following two discussions I'm going to have with you, microbial involvement as a cofactor in disease etiology, and considering the overall importance of a multifactorial causative nature, meaning you got to have a lot of different things wrong to have AIDS, I'll come back to a number of questions that Schmidt has answered, but not fully enough. He talks about new right ascendancy, but explains neither why it gained this ascendancy, which I can only explore briefly, nor how the early AIDS campaigners, especially, but not only those in the homosexual community, combined fighting against the illness with battling the darkness spread by some of the politically reactionary groups out there. And I believe we are all experienced with who they are and what that negative stereotyping has done to a society. After all, if you've been marginalized, I think that you'd be very concerned about it, and you would know who was marginalizing you and what their political beliefs were, and you'd be concerned. So I'm going to deal with that. Safe sex was viewed by the early AIDS activists not merely as a practice to be imposed on the reluctant, but as a form of political resistance and community building. It was this liberatory subtext that seemed most to raise the ire of the more conservatives within our society, and more fundamentalistic. And it was the first premise of safe sex organizing to be lost when professionals unveiled their plans for safer sex education. Now, we'll see that Schmidt's complaints about weaknesses in the gay community, although he does praise ACT UP, miss both early strengths and the way a number of the deformities that have hindered its full empowerment were introduced from outside by professionals and others who were implicitly fighting against the self-assertion and autonomy of the affected. It'll be most appropriate to conclude our discussion of multifactorial causation with such material because, as Patton shows, the early intra-community AIDS activists were highly effective in changing sexual and drug-taking behavior, relying on an ad hoc multifactorial ideology, since much of this work was done before the putative discovery of HIV and before testing. Patton notes, quote, men understood and made major effective changes without the benefit of antibody tests. And before making this case for multifactorial causation and looking at the benefits produced by holding such a view in terms of understanding and working against the disease, as well as the light it sheds on the issues of whether AIDS calls for the adoption of new medical paradigms, we need to focus on one other group of immune-suppressed weakeners, one we have repeatedly mentioned in passing on previous programs, but not specifically targeted. That is sexually transmitted diseases and other infections. And also, some people may be confused. If they hear me say that AIDS has never been proven to be passed sexually, that runs right in the face of everything we've been taught from AIDS organizations and ACT UP spokespersons and Gay Men's Health Alliance and the federal government. But I challenge them, show me your evidence. Show me your facts, and I'll show you my facts. And their facts, I have dissected, I have dismantled completely, because there's a difference between having safe sex because you do not want a sexually transmitted disease that's reasonable and responsible, and suggesting that if AIDS is not contracted sexually, then we're promoting unsafe sex, which is not the case at all. So we must separate out the issues. Let's take a look at microbial activity. When we talked about the dangers of the fast-track gay males were exposing themselves to, as when we took up the issue of poppers, which was on a previous program, there was always some allusion to the high risk of and contraction of sexually transmitted diseases in this population, meaning the men who were taking these poppers. Why? Because, as I explained then, when I would go to the gay bars and all the gay places in New York, San Francisco to interview these individuals, they would tell me, Gary, I'm having the time of my life. I'm having a great time. I'm not doing this to hurt myself. I'm liberated sexually. I can have sex 10, 20, 30 times a night. Yes, I actually spoke with men who could have 36 episodes a night. And I said, well, my God, your body can't produce that kind of semen. Well, they would have what are called dry orgasms. They would have the sensation of an orgasm, the feeling of an orgasm. They just wouldn't have any ejaculate fluid. Well, I said, well, as a heterosexual male, maybe two or three times, and then you're exhausted, and you want to go to sleep. How can you keep awake and still keep the sexual desire going 20 times? And the answer would be poppers, amyl nitrate. Break open one of those smelling salt capsules and put it under your nose, and woo, you're awake, you're alive, you expand the orgasm. So in other words, you're taking poppers because it increases sexual stimulation. But then go back to the 1970s, the heterosexuals, especially the Long Island, West Hampton, garment industry crowd, and that was primarily as a group who went to West Hampton. It was people in the garment industry because they were considered the most hip drug users, the sex parties, the swingers, singles, and couple swinging parties. And they used poppers across the board. What's of interest is later I would counsel many of those people who had been heavy into the heterosexual sexual liberation groups who used poppers, but not necessarily other drugs, lots of alcohol and smoked. They came down with the same type of diseases that we now call AIDS. But because they were in a primarily heterosexual group, it wasn't called AIDS. It was called chronic fatigue syndrome. It was called autoimmune disease. And when I would do detailed backgrounds, which are very comprehensive, frequently having them fill out as many as 3,000 questions, answers to questions, and I have a questionnaire which is 3,000 questions. That's how detailed it is. It takes them about a week and a half to fill it out at home. But it shows a picture. And then you start saying, yeah, they were taking amine nitrates. That was the party favorite in the sexual liberated groups, heterosexuals and gays. But it was the gays that got caught with it, not the heterosexuals. And the gays would have all the sex, and because of the poppers. Well, that poppers played havoc with the immune system. Also, there was some allusion to the high risk of a contraction of sexually transmitted disease in this population. It was also mentioned that the group was over-prescribed. Mind you, you couldn't get this stuff without prescription, and perhaps self-prescribing antibiotics, which, like sexually transmitted diseases, was doing no favors to the immune system. I saw this when for about 6 months I wanted to see what was happening in the heterosexual sex community. So I went to all the clubs, Plato's Retreat, and all the places that were open for primarily heterosexual sex. And man, it was rampant. It was everywhere. And there was no hiding it. People went there because they either wanted to be exhibitionistic and wanted to explore their sexuality. But everywhere you went, you saw people taking pills all night long. I asked, what are the pills? Antibiotics, penicillin. Really? Why are you taking them? Well, to prevent herpes or to prevent gonorrhea. Gonorrhea was the big thing at the time. And I would mention, well, you know, you can't prevent gonorrhea by taking penicillin. And they'd look at you like, well, of course you can, because if you get gonorrhea and you take penicillin, it helps clear it up. I said, but it doesn't act prophylactically, just depresses the immune system. Generally, end of conversation. Well, as much as the heterosexual community would do it, and generally it was periodic, maybe on weekends, Friday and Saturdays, the gay community, the fast-track gay community, I should say, it was every night. And I followed a whole group of the fast-track gays. There was a school principal in the Bronx who at nighttime would go out to the clubs every single night, and he would take a handful of them. I was sitting with him, having dinner, doing a conversation with him, and I wanted to see what this whole lifestyle was like. And right before dinner, he pulls out a bottle, and he takes out 10 penicillin, high potency, and he pops them down. I said, what's that for? He says, prevent sexually transmitted disease. I don't want sexually transmitted disease. I said, but that's, are you aware of the side effects? Have you actually looked in the scientific literature as to what those antibiotics will do to your immune system? He said, well, my doctor gave them to me. If they were that bad, Gary, he wouldn't have given them to me. So a week later, when I met him again, because I was meeting him every week to talk with him about his life and his health, I asked him, did you read up on the side effects? And he had not. So I had photocopied all the scientific literature on the side effects of antibiotic overuse. And I said, now, does this remind you of the people that you have met within your community? And I started reading off the conditions that come from this, including a condition at the time, which was gay men's irritable bowel syndrome. And it was so specific to gays because of anal intercourse and fisting. And I tried to explain that when you have that unprotected rectal intercourse, if you're the recipient, and it's tearing the sensitive lining of your mucosal membranes in your colon, all the fecal matter that's then in that colon and the other person's blood or semen, your own blood and semen, that then goes into the body, creates an enormous antibody reaction. In effect, the body starts attacking itself. And also, you've got all those pollutants. You've got E. coli. You have terribly toxic pollutants in your fecal matter. Now it's in your own blood system. And I said, do you think that antibiotics are what you need for that? Oh, yeah. And they had this whole myth going around, including gay doctors who I've interviewed in the clubs, who absolutely believe that as long as you took the antibiotics, you were protected. It was a lie. Can't protect yourself. It's a myth. Yet that's what they were doing by the millions. Everywhere you went, everyone had all the antibiotics you'd want. And you could get any antibiotic or any drug. So then they started taking the amyl nitrate, and I showed them the scientific literature on amyl nitrate, what poppers do, depresses the immune system. And again, it was as if there was a denial because they were having too much fun. Now, then there was cocaine. There was angel dust. There was ecstasy. There was smack. And there was heroin also being used. And you start taking all that stuff, and plus the bacteria, and plus what was called rimming, which was the oral sex, one man to another man, on a man's rectum, and with all the bacteria that is on there, you are loading your body to a capacity the body cannot possibly defend. And then they were getting these sexually transmitted diseases one after the other after the other. And so then when I would later write about this, pre-AIDS, I wrote about AIDS. Pre any antibody test, pre the discovery of the so-called HIV virus, I was already writing and broadcasting specials on the lifestyle of the heterosexual fast track and the gay fast track and what it would do to them. Now, mind you, it had nothing to do with multiple sexual partners. I don't care how many sexual partners you have. If you practice safe sex, you don't end up with anything except the pleasurable experience to the degree that you desire that. But a society that condemns sexual promiscuity then sees your redemption through the disease that you contract and your suffering through that. Like, see, you didn't do what mother or father said, you didn't know what priest or rabbi said, you're out there doing things that are not good, and now you're suffering, so suffer. You deserve it, and maybe you'll learn from this. That was the mindset of so many people who are moralizing against people who were having sex. In point of fact, only about 3% of the American population, gay or heterosexual, ever participated in sexual liberation. 97% of both gay and heterosexual stood on the sidelines, looking in amazement, looking with pure and delight or disgust, and either wishing that they could be in that position but never would, or condemning what they saw as such terrible behavior that it was undermining the morals of their children or the larger moral context of a society. So there wasn't a whole lot of care about what people were coming down with. And the people were coming down with it, as long as they could keep functioning, what the heck? Take some pills. The drip dries up, you go back, and you keep doing it. Hence today, when the group of heterosexuals who stopped their sexual practices in the 1970s or early 80s, today when I do a blood workup on these people, take a look at their blood workup, it's loaded with everything. Everything. They don't even know they have syphilis. I got syphilis I see on these, herpes 1, 2, and 6, every form of this, genital warts, papillomavirus. The only thing they may not be aware of, because they don't have any overt symptoms of it. And all of this is immunosuppressive. So do they ever connect all of this to the illnesses they suffer now? No. Cancer? Fatigue? No. Oxidative stress? Nope. That's why you've got to pull back and go clear back and connect all the dots. And then you see that what you did before stays with you. Now let's just take a look at syphilis. But remember, you must distinguish being sexually promiscuous. If you are wise in what you do, and hopefully are doing it for the right reasons, because you enjoy it, it's your right, it's your liberation, at your sense of autonomy, will not result in immunosuppression. Doing it foolishly will. Doing it with utter abandonment, is what was happening in the 70s in heterosexual fast-tracking gays, will absolutely destroy your immune system. So later, all we needed was to have the mythological HIV virus, and now we made no one responsible for all their lifestyle. We simply said it's a virus. How politically convenient. But it worked. Syphilis, we should focus on. You never hear syphilis talked about, yet it is rampant. Though across the broad spectrum, heterosexuals and homosexuals are equally likely to take hard drugs, I show that one drug, poppers, was taken, aside from those who took it for medical reasons, almost exclusively for fast-track gays and the swingers. In the same way, though, sexually transmitted diseases are equally widespread over the sexual spectrum. Syphilis, according to studies by the Los Angeles Health Department, epidemiological studies, is most frequently found in male homosexuals. Quote, if you are gay in the United States, statistically you are 1,400% more likely to have had syphilis than if you are heterosexual, unquote. Now, although whether there is a causal link of syphilis to AIDS is unknown, findings by the Los Angeles Health Department set forth in 1989 and based upon independent epidemiological studies, which concluded that, quote, a history of syphilis is the most common predictor of the development of AIDS in the absence of all other factors, unquote, is certainly suggestive, hinting at some compact between the two diseases. Yet do you hear that today? Not at all. We do know that syphilis jeopardizes immunity. While it is of special interest that almost all of the symptoms of AIDS are also documented symptoms of secondary and tertiary syphilis, they're virtually indistinguishable. And yet today, ask the average physician, have you checked your patient for syphilis? The answer is, no, why should I? Because the symptoms of syphilis are indistinguishable from that of AIDS. Oh, really? Yeah, the chemical immunosuppression drugs that you're giving and syphilis can cause full-blown AIDS. Let's look at herpes. To see in a more blow-by-blow fashion how a sexually transmitted disease disables immune function, we might consult the work of Nina Ostrom, an outstanding reporter and former managing director of the now-defunct New York Native, who has written on findings on human herpes virus 6, made at Columbia University and other institutions. Human herpes 6, Ostrom explained when I interviewed her, has two varieties, A and B. Type B is common and benign, while type A is found in people with AIDS and other immune compromised conditions. She maintained, quote, scientific paper after scientific paper show that this virus does to people and how it destroys their immune systems, unquote. Its actions is to destroy such vital parts of the immune reaction organized as T cells, B cells, and natural killer cells, destroys them right across the board, so that in her definition, quote, it's the real heavyweight virus in AIDS, unquote. A question, has your doctor ever suggested that instead of an HIV antibody test that you had a human herpes 6 test? No, again. Heterosexual or homosexual, wouldn't matter. Yet when I see the tested blood of a heterosexual who has human herpes 6, I almost always see the condition known as chronic fatigue syndrome. Heal the body of the virus, which you can do. In fact, I have protocols for it. Suddenly, the person no longer has chronic fatigue syndrome. In a person with AIDS, see if they have human herpes 6. Across the board, almost universally, they have it. Heal the body of human herpes 6, and lo and behold, you frequently see persons who had full-blown AIDS who begin to respond and their immune system rebuilt. So it is, not just according to Nina Ostrom, from my own experience, one of the heavyweights in causing what we call AIDS. So we tested everyone for herpes 6, which is testable, which is not going to have these false positives. You would see that we have planted in our system the very means of destroying our immune system. It destroys T cells, B cells, natural killer cells. In fact, what I did was this. I took a group of individuals who had no no risk factors for AIDS. None. And we measured their T cells, and we measured their, for human herpes 6, those that had human herpes 6 all had depressed T cells down to the level of a person with AIDS. Now, they didn't know that. But do you know at that time, just with a low under 200 T cell, that alone would have been enough of a diagnosis to classify them as having AIDS. Yet these were healthy heterosexuals. In fact, most of them were marathon runners. But with human herpes 6, their immune system was being depressed also, and they had low T cell count. Moreover, this is not a virus with whom those with AIDS have a passing acquaintance. Herpes is found in almost every case of full-blown AIDS. The herpes virus has immune suppression properties by itself, herpes 1, 2, and 6. That's why when you get a fever blister on your lip when you get sick, it shows immune suppression. Well, a fever blister is both the cause and the symptom. You see the symptom. Oh, I've got a fever blister. Do you ever get a fever blister when you're not stressed, when you're healthy and happy? You get it when you're sick, stressed, worn out, not getting sleep, not getting rest, not eating right, under psychic stress. Herpes are not innocuous. Time and again, I've heard doctors say, oh, you've got herpes virus. Everyone's got herpes. Don't worry about it. Wrong advice. The herpes virus is absolutely, unequivocally immunosuppressive. And it can increase the replication, according to the scientific studies, of serious viruses in your body. Now, if you looked at the scientific work of Constance Cox and Donald Kerrigan, they demonstrated, quote, 100% of HIV-infected patients studied, that means 10 out of 10, had active human herpes 6 variant A infection in their lymph nodes early in the course of the disease, unquote. The scientists who have focused their studies on understanding HIV and human herpes 6 adapt the supposition shared by others that the long period between infection with HIV and the breakdown or breakout of AIDS, accompanied by an upping of the amount of HIV seroretrovirus in the affected, can be accounted for by the hypothesis that the immune system has to be partially deranged already with HIV to rear its head. And since in 75% of the patients in their trial had herpes in an early stage of AIDS, they surmise, quote, the A variant of human herpes 6 is capable of breaking HIV latency with the potential for helping to catalyze the progression of HIV infection to AIDS, unquote. Now, what that means in lay language is this. If you believed that HIV existed, and that's still debatable, but if you said, all right, HIV's real, for argument's sake, we'll say it's real, and you have it, for whatever reason, as long as you didn't have the cofactors like human herpes 6, it is meaningless. But if you have human herpes 6, a high percentage of people are going to go right into AIDS in a relatively short period of time. And it's not because of the HIV virus, it's because of human herpes 6. We have seen that herpes and syphilis are found in conjunction with AIDS, and that even without being connected to the immune deficiency syndrome, these sexually transmitted viral infections undercut the immune system. The same can be said for, in talking with of other sexually transmitted disease, what can be called the usual suspects. Although it's not charged that all these other agents prepare the way for HIV to emerge from its latency, as we've seen many dissidents don't feel HIV's role is crucial to AIDS anyway, these sexually transmitted diseases are said to promote the transmission and destructiveness of the disease. Epstein-Barr virus increases the penetration of white blood cells by the HIV virus, according to those who accept HIV exists. Moreover, where herpes lesions or lesions of syphilis, molluscum, or papillomavirus are present, HIV virus spread much more quickly from person to person, according to their theory. As Dr. Philpott notes, many of these sexually transmitted diseases have been indicatable by the very beginning, from the very beginning, as accessories to the disease. And since in Gallo's original findings of HIV in association with the disease, he actually could isolate the retrovirus in only half of the blood specimens. Yet they all had other infections. Some of them seemed to have HIV infections, but all of them, every one of them, had infection with all sorts of germs. That is, from other viral infections. Could he ever find the HIV virus in a healthy person? No. Where did he find it? In sick people. What were they sick with? Sexually transmitted diseases more often than not. And as I've noted, the gay male subgroup, particularly those who ran in the fast lane, had a high propensity to having been, at one time or another, hit with sexually transmitted diseases as well as other infectious agents. And in his book, Rethinking AIDS, Dr. Ruth Bernstein has dug into the problem. The most immunosuppressive of those he found are cytomegalovirus, herpes simplex viruses, 1, 2, and 6, Epstein-Barr virus, hepatitis B and hepatitis C, mycobacteria species, mycoplasma species, and candida. And it is the combination of these, and you can end up with one or many of these. Now, if you're very promiscuous, the likelihood is you've got them all. In fact, in heterosexuals who are sick today, I can find almost all of these in every single one of these people. Remember, we accumulate these viruses by our interactions, not just sexually. Sexually is one way, but you could get herpes from eating in a restaurant from a fork or drinking from a glass that wasn't sterilized. And how many of the restaurants you know really sterilize? Hot water doesn't sterilize. You have to get the temperature way up, and most restaurants, it's been shown, do not sterilize. So what if you're eating from a fork that someone who has a syphilis? You could get syphilis. Oh, by the way, you could get syphilis from shaking someone's hand who has syphilis. So you don't necessarily have to engage in the actual sexual acts to get actual sexual diseases. Let's just understand that every one of these sexually transmitted diseases and non-sexually transmitted viruses, every one of them is a bane to the immune system. Cytomegalovirus, herpes, and Epstein-Barr infect macrophages and lymphocytes and cause a decrease in CD4 cells and an increase in CD8 cells, leading to a reverse CD4-CD8 ratio, a situation characteristic of people with AIDS. And besides reversing the CD4 and CD8 ratio, hepatitis can also cause severe liver damage, impairing its ability to cleanse the body from accumulating drug toxicity. If you're looking for the culprits that helped AIDS break and enter, then it would certainly seem more justifiable to grill sexually transmitted diseases whose potency and previous trespasses are already down on the charge sheet than pull in this innocuous, possibly non-existent HIV, which may be no more than an innocent bystander, and it is at most a first offender. As the list Ruth Bernstein prepared suggests, it is not only infections that are passed along by sexual intercourse that seem to have a hand in AIDS disease. Other infections may well be active in softening up the immune system. These frontline sappers include, in the words of Dr. Eva Sneed, quote, yeast or candida infections, toxicities, commercial drugs such as lithium, malnutrition, Kalazar and other parasite disorders, measles. He finds that these candidates for involvement because each, quote, can cause T-cell changes similar to those we see in AIDS. Now, Dr. Watson, in an article on parasitology, lays his finger on another component that should be gauged when we look into sources of immune suppression, like poppers. He says, quote, parasites readily accompany a fast-track lifestyle. He points out, quote, cocaine and alcohol, for instance, have been shown to reduce resistance to intestinal parasites and intestinal lymphocyte numbers. Just having parasites. Well, who gets parasites? Well, you can get parasites from drinking tap water. You can get parasites from eating a salad in a salad bar where the person who handled the salad originally did not have clean hands. But that also is one way, but more likely if you've had anal intercourse, you're far more likely to have parasites. And those parasites can last forever. And what are the symptoms of parasite toxicity? Almost indistinguishable from that of AIDS. When I interviewed Dr. Joan Priestley for a discussion on this program, she said that with persons with AIDS, she said, I parasite test everyone who comes in through the door, whether or not they have any known risk factors, whether or not they have any diarrhea or any gastrointestinal problems. And she says, across the board, I see parasites. And with that, those are contributors to AIDS, unquote. From one way of looking at it, I'm doing exactly what I've accused establishment of doing, fishing for a connection between AIDS and a physical manifestation that is found accompanying it, and then proclaiming that the two are casually married. That is, I am basing my argument on a correlation while hinting that there is a casual relationship or causal relationship underlying it. However, to upbraid me for following steps I disallow others would be to make a false analogy. Where the Orthodox holds a strong version of the cause-effect doctrine, acting alone, HIV causes AIDS, that's their view. You don't need anything else. You don't need parasites, herpes 6, cytomegaly, hepatitis. You don't need malnutrition, paupers. You don't need antibiotic overuse, alcohol. You don't need stress. None of that causes AIDS. Just this virus that you can't find in anyone's body, but it's there. We're sure it's hiding out in lymph glands and killing it some way that we're trying to theorize does it. Mind you, they've had to theorize because no one's ever actually proven it. I hold a different version. I argue that a number of factors in varied combinations, their multiplicity accounting for different ways AIDS mixes with related diseases, tear down the immune system, and in those that are considered at risk will produce what we call AIDS, but in those not considered at risk will cause cancer, chronic fatigue, arthritis, autoimmune illnesses, heart disease, dementia. It's different. All of those have something in common, challenges the immune system. It's not yet the time, this will come in a minute, to expound on why multifactorial explanations are generally preferable to monocausistic ones. But I can say that from the point of view of the Orthodox, my method here may be compared to Bacon, Sir Francis Bacon's search for instances of union. He says, quote, they are those which mingle and unite nature supposed to be heterogeneous and marked and set down as such in the received divisions. The received divisions, that's important, unquote. These would be the pockets devised by the AIDS establishment, one of which holds AIDS and HIV and another which holds syphilis and other sexually transmitted diseases. For example, which are said to be unimportant contingencies in connecting to the union of immune dysfunction illness. I challenge that. Let's take one of Bacon's examples. He remarks that it is generally believed that there are three separate genesis of fire whose natures are different and which cannot intermingle. The fire of the sun has a fructifying and generifying power since it helps crops to grow, while earthly fire is generally malign, for, quote, the heat of the fire wastes and destroys. However, this too hastily categorization slips the following fact. When a branch of vine is brought within a house where fire is constantly kept up, the grapes ripen to a whole month sooner than they would outdoors, so the ripening of the fruit becomes a raisin. It may be brought about by fire. So the instance shows that the divisions artificially imposed by science in this day were short-sighted by placing different elements of nature in watertight compartments. In this discussion of microbial activity, similar claims are being made about the lack of just common sense in the Orthodox decision to dismiss the implication of viral or medications, or any other cause, or infections or inflammatory processes in the bringing of birth of AIDS. They just refuse to accept this. No matter what arguments you bring, they simply categorically say, none of this has anything to do with AIDS. And I say it has everything to do with AIDS. Without inflammatory processes, without using these drugs, without having these multiple sexually transmitted infections, without these parasites, without nutritional deficiencies like zinc deficiency from constant sperm depletion, you could not have AIDS. You just couldn't have it, and they can't show me a model of it. But don't confuse orthodox science with facts. The statistics provided, for example, the constant companionship of syphilis and AIDS indicate that here are two entities which mingle and unite nature supposed to be heterogeneous. In our next program, I will plumb for the general validity of a reclassification that acknowledges that many factors, many cofactors, should be causally associated with AIDS. I will look at the papyri of cofactors noted as preparatory to presentation of multi-causal thesis. At this time, however, science, medicine, legislation, funding is not willing to acknowledge that. I would have hoped for a more enlightened era. We don't have it. We have to work with what we have. I would hope that people within the AIDS community would stop for a moment and say, what really caused this? What level did our stress, our lifestyles, our immune function play? What role does the medication play? That's not being done. To them, the only problem with sex was not the hepatitis. It was the spread of this mythical virus. So to them, using a condom meant that now they can have safe sex. But what about their malnutrition, their parasites? What about the previous syphilis they had, herpes 6, they've never tested for? Those to them are unimportant. To me, they are very important. I'm Gary Nall. That brings us up to the end of another program. I want to thank you for listening and bearing a witness to what could be, for some people, hopefully, a reevaluation. This is part 21 of the ongoing in-depth investigative reporting series, AIDS, A Second Opinion, Deconstructing the Myth of AIDS, an examination of cofactors, including stress.